And welcome back to another edition of Sideline Sessions with Wesley Sykes. I am, of course, Wesley Sykes, the managing editor of Coach and Athletic Director, Training and Conditioning, and Winning Hoops Brands for Great American Media Services. And you can listen to all of our previous episodes anywhere you can access podcasts, as well as any of our websites. That's coachad.com, training-conditioning.com, and winninghoops.com. And be sure to follow all of our brands on Twitter as well. That's coach_AD, at train condition, and at winning hoops. And then myself, if you'd like, along the way, that's at Wesley Sykes _. And today we welcome to the program very special guest, a former Super Bowl champion and current head coach of the Lipscomb Academy Mustangs in Tennessee. That's Mr. Trent Dilfer. So thank you very much for taking the time to chat with us. Trent, how are you?
I'm doing great. Fired up to be here, Wesley.
All right. So, so let's before we dive into some of the heavy hitting questions here, let's get tell us a little bit about your collaboration with Ace Sports.
Oh, I'm fired up. You know, it was interesting. A lot of what's happened here at Lipscomb just kind of was birthed out of my chief of staff and I, who's been with me for 12 years, Elite 11, ESPN, just brainstorming on how to build better culture, how to bring communities together, how to help distressed communities in Middle Tennessee. And one of the visions was, you know, we need to be able to generate ad dollars. We need to have a revenue platform on campus. You know, a lot of the private schools around the country, they're donor-based, they're development-based programs, which is nothing wrong with that. But at some point, you can only go to the one family so many times and ask them to support different things. So you have to develop some revenue platforms. And we really want to give back. One of the things we're doing here at Lipscomb is not just building what we hope to be the best high school program in the country here in the near future, but we want to, while doing that, reach into some distressed communities and give them field time and let them create revenue platforms for themselves. For instance, girls soccer leagues in Antioch that are going away during COVID, let them have field space, let them have games, tournaments, don't charge them any field rentals, let them fund their programs. Well, part of that was we needed a Jumbotron. We needed a revenue platform. We wanted to celebrate with the great things going on here, but just as importantly, we wanted to have the opportunity to create some revenue, and came across Mark Bridges, Ace Sports, Arkansas-based company, did some due diligence, realized that they're building the best boards out there, cutting edge in what they're doing, really great people to work with, get the kind of the high school, small college challenges, some school district challenges, private school challenges, and developed a great relationship with them. And we'll have the biggest, baddest board going up in Tennessee here soon, and should be great for our community and for the communities that surround us.
Awesome. I love it here. And again, before we dive in, I think it's important when we have a conversation to be able to define the terms of which we're talking about here. So can you define to me what it means to be a dude and what the difference is between a dude and a unicorn?
So we came up with that, you know. One of the tricks I learned in coaching, because I was around some great ones, Mike Holmgren, I'll steal from Mike Holmgren here. He would have like 10 different ways of explaining the same thing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the simplest way of creating a word picture really resonated with players. So when we started Elite 11, we were really trying to get them to understand what it meant to have a certain presence to you, a presence that's infectious. We call it thermostat leadership. You don't just go into a room and adapt to the temperature of the room. You go into a room and jack it up with your presence. A guy that carries himself in a certain – guy or gal. I talk to my daughters about having dude qualities all the time. Where you walk in and you might be dealing with something. You might have nerves. You might be scared. You might have some insecurities. But that doesn't portray to the people around you. All you spill off is confidence. You're going to make those around you better. Something that doesn't make little things big things. They don't get caught up in drama. Something bad happens, water off a duck's back, move on to the next thing. That's what a dude is. Those are what dude qualities are. We found a way to say, create a word picture and then explain what looking like a dude meant. And it's really resonated with those guys over the years at Elite 11. It resonates with the players here. when I have a chance to explain it, people kind of have the aha moment, like, oh yeah, that makes sense.
Right.
You know who the dudes are in your life, right? You know who they are in the family. We have them in our family. We got three girls, my wife and me, and we know who the dude is, and it ain't me. So, you know, it's just every family has it. Every organization has it. If you're high performing, you're going to have a presence of those dude qualities because they make everybody else around that organization work better.
And it sounds like it's not just something you're born with, too. It sounds like something that maybe you can develop these dude qualities over time and just through experience.
Listen, I get a lot of arguments with some really smart people around the country, but I'm a nurture over nature guy. I think almost everything can be nurtured. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of our, yes, you have personality traits, but those things can grow, right? We're all, if we have a growth mindset, can grow and get better at things. And I think this is one of those things that you can see. I'll use my quarterback as an example. He's one of the best quarterbacks in the country, just thrived at Elite 11. Great kid. When he came here as a sophomore, he did not have a lot of dude qualities. Mm-hmm. Now they just pour out of him. And he's worked hard at that. He's worked hard at trying to understand what that is. He's worked hard through insecurities. He's worked hard through challenges. He's been very transparent through all that. And I think because of that, he's owned it. And he said, okay, here's the vision of what I want to look like one day. And now he's really starting to look like it.
I love that. And I feel like you started to allude to this in your answer, describing yourself as a nurturer here. But you know, after a pro career, you know, you're winning a Super Bowl, you're a part of an all-time team, a very successful TV career. You know, why go to the high school level, whether it be through the NFL Legends, you know, Youth Advisory Committee, your Elite 11 camps that you've run, or just coaching at Lipscomb?
The easy answer is calling. Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, it's how I was wired at this stage of my life. It's like all my life's adventure, circumstances, the journey of my life has allowed me to be called to do this right now. That's probably the easy answer. Mm-hmm. The more complex one is, I was in a stage of life where I feel like I was taking more than I was giving and felt convicted on that and really wanted to be a giver, not a taker. And I can't think of a better place. Yes. Ask your high school teachers around the country, your middle school teachers, administrators, anybody that works with youth, you're forced to be a giver, not a taker. And this is kind of in my world where football is what I have a PhD in. This is kind of what the best place I can give back. I love the relational part of it, the nurturing part of it. I've always loved and felt gifted building teams. I was not a great player in the NFL. I'm the first to self-deprecate and be honest to him, say I'm disappointed that I didn't reach my potential as a player. But the one thing I'm very proud of is every team I ever played on from high school to the time I retired was better after I left than I got there. Mm-hmm. Wins, losses, culture, you name it. We were always better after I left. I always took a lot of pride in helping the team grow. I always felt like I had a vision for what gaps needed to be filled, what strengths to emphasize, what weaknesses to develop within a team setting, an organizational setting. So it's something I feel as a gift. I probably learned it from my parents, administrators, coaches. Learned it from the other great people I've been around. And this is a great way. It was more than building a team here. When I took over, they hadn't won a lot of games in a lot of years. And it was kind of down and out. And it was more than just building a team. It was building back a community where football was the front porch to that community. It was about growing a lot of ways, growing in making the school look more like the world instead of like a little suburb in Nashville. So I felt like I had a vision for that, a strength set for that. And it's really been, I always say it's been neat to see my pain in my life repurposed into passion, and the passion to build this community and the passion to build this team. For right now, this stage of my life, this season of my life is I'm right where I'm supposed to be.
You know, I like that. I think that's really, really well said there. And again, I feel like you got into this a little bit, but when you talk about kind of being a new coach and getting a team to buy into your system and to mm-hmm. your philosophy, I think obviously, like you mentioned, you have a PhD in the game of football, but I think just based on your previous answer, you know, you have a philosophical look about the game that extends beyond the field a little bit. And I think, you know, if you're going to be a head coach, and this is just my opinion here, but yeah, I think you have to have that impact on a player's life or a team's life that's going to go just beyond, you know, the wins and losses, right?
Yeah, I think there's this, you know, people package a lot of different ways. There's a lot of great books written on it. I think the easiest way I would explain it is you have to find a way to get the most from the least and the best from the best mm-hmm. as a coach. And the way you do that isn't through X's and O's, although that's very important. It isn't technique, although that's very important. It isn't through discipline, although that's super important. It isn't through accountability, although very important. It's tapping into their soul. It's connecting. I would say John Gordon challenged me a few years ago to find a word. It was the first year I was here, a word to base my whole life off that year. And I took that serious. I didn't just kind of go to the dictionary and look for words. I prayed over it. I thought over it. I sought counsel on it. And a gap in my life was that I was not a great connector. I had a lot of friends. I had a lot of acquaintances, I had a lot of relationships around the country, but I hadn't connected in a deep level with people like I thought I should and that I needed to. My family recognized that in me. And so connection kind of became that hallmark for me, that cornerstone. And what I learned through it was as you make deep connections with players, now all of a sudden you can get the most from the least and the best from the best. And it's not just in a athletic setting, you get it from them in a life setting. And what we're seeing is miraculous with our student athletes. It's 56 D's and F's on our roster when I get in here, and then at the end of the first semester there's four.
Right. Wow.
They're non-existent at this point. And we don't talk about academics that much. We really don't. We talk about pursuing, chasing your best. Mm-hmm. We talk about what it looks like to be set apart, what it looks like to live your life in an uncommon way in every area of your life. And then what we always talk about, if you have one giant bucket that you're pouring into and that bucket is pursuing your best, well, when it starts filling up, it's going to pour into all these other buckets, academics, relationships, football, strength and conditioning, whatever it is. And what we're seeing is as we get guys, as we connect with them, we're authentic with them, they trust us. They don't always like me. Today, my offensive line did not like me, trust me. Yeah. But they trust me. And they trust that I'm in it for them. They know that the criticism, the critiquing that they're getting is for them, not for me. As that trust level grows, as you're transparent with them, you're authentic with them, you connect with them at a special level, you start getting a lot out of them. And you start seeing them truly pursue something bigger than a grade or a performance. Their identity start getting wrapped up in something far bigger than those things. And now you really start seeing the fullness of who they are come out.
Now that's interesting. Could you go into a little more about the idea of friendships and acquaintances and then really connecting on the next level and what the and what that means?
Yeah, I think you got to get dirty. I think when you're, and this is how I was, so I'm not criticizing anybody that's listening. Mm-hmm. I was this way. When it was easy, when friendships were convenient, they were fun, there wasn't a lot of conflict, when acquaintances were the same way, they fit into a bucket of your life, right? They're your go out to friends bucket, or they were your vacation bucket, or they're your volleyball friend bucket. When they fit into a bucket and everything's easy, you don't really connect, you just have easy. When you're willing to get dirty with people and ask them their why and let them know your why, and agree to disagree and have hard conversations and not react to the narratives that are going around our country, instead dive into those relationally and really figure out why somebody thinks the way they do and appreciate that and have empathy for that, where they, how they grew up, what their background's like, what their family situations are like. And you really start doing the ugly, hard stuff with people. Now you start connecting with them. Mm-hmm. When you have to deal with parents and be honest about their kid's ability long term, and is he a college player, is he a role player, is he a high school player, stuff he's doing off the field is affecting him on the field, Is he making bad decisions? What's going on at home? You start having some tough conversations. You start having to connect with people because you don't want just to be conflict all the time. Being available. I think being available is a really hard thing. I had a very glamorous life, fun life, country club style life. And all of a sudden get text 11:35 at night while I'm living in my office instead of my house, and returning those calls and being available for people's problems. The biggest question I get asked is, what's the biggest challenge of being a head coach? And it's every family's issue has to be your biggest issue because it's their biggest issue, right? If you're a parent right now and you have Sally and she's a seventh grade volleyball player and she rolls her ankle and you got a doctor's appointment and this, this, and that, that's a big issue for Sally and her family. It has to be the coach's big issue too, to connect with them. Or you just brush it off and you're a matter of fact. And hey, when Sally's back, Sally's back. But that's not how we wanted to do this thing. We wanted to connect with our players. We wanted to put ourselves in their shoes. Most of us, some of us older guys, Phil Dawson, 21 years in the NFL, 3 kids, 1 in college. Grant Williams, 3 daughters, all volleyball players, all in college. 10-year NFL vet. Myself, 14-year NFL vet, raised 4 kids, lost a child, have 3 in college, all Power 5 athletes or Division 1 athletes. You know, we've done it. So we've been on the other side. So I think we have a different perspective on what the parent goes through. You know, a lot of coaches are really scared of parents' opinions. We welcome them. We welcome their opinions. Not saying we're going to react to them, but we welcome them because sometimes a parent just needs to let some steam off. Sometimes a parent needs to throw up on you verbally a little bit to get some stuff out. And that's going to help Johnny when he goes home, because now dad's not going to throw up on Johnny because he got the chance of throwing up on Coach Dilfer. That's something a lot of coaches don't want to take the time to do. We're willing to do that. We're willing to let parents vent to us a little bit, dump some stuff on us, have conversations about it, give them our perspective. And we've changed, honestly. We've had parents come into us and sit us down, say, here's what we're seeing. And instead of reacting to it, like, huh, you know what? We did not realize that was happening. And we have not taken enough time to appreciate your side of this. And now we're going to take a closer look at this, and we've changed how we've done some things. So I think that's connection. It's being available. It's willing to get into some really hard, dirty, ugly stuff sometimes that's healthy. We always say conflict. Without growth, without conflict, there's no growth. But the conflict has to be handled well. We talk a lot about how to handle conflict. Again, another form of connection.
I appreciate that. I love that. Because again, I thought you're hitting on that, and it's something that I think in my own personal life that I can do a better job of. And I think when you talk about being, you know, friends in a bucket and sort of things like that, and when it's convenient for you, and you know, I think that's something I've definitely learned over the last few years, leaving college and entering into full adulthood here. And it's tough. It's difficult, I think, too. You know, it's, I think, to kind of make that change. But I appreciate that on a personal level. That note there. But from a competitor standpoint, and you mentioned some of the your coaching staff here, particularly, you know, some who's competed on the highest of levels. How do you go about accepting a different role from what you're used to? And maybe as a follow up, how can that maybe help you in your off the field career? Cause if I could use yourself as an example, you know, I look at the tail end of your career, you know, mentoring the likes of like Matt Hasselbeck or Alex Smith, and kind of seeing how well they've done. To your point earlier, leaving places better than where you've entered them. But that also seemed to kind of transition well into your Elite 11 camps and what you're doing now, and that idea of kind of being a nurturer.
Yeah, I really did. It, you know, and I, trust me, I wish I was a Hall of Famer. I wish I would have tapped into all my potential and played better and thought better thoughts and worked harder and all the things. I always tell my kids, you know, you get the experience. You get to experience my coaching is a lot of what I didn't do. I don't think Elite 11 or my team here at Lipscomb's ever heard do it that way because I did it that way. I think they usually hear, here's some mistakes I made that I don't want you to make. Learn from my mistakes so you don't have to make them yourself. But yeah, the back end of my career was really fruitful. It really started when I went to Baltimore.
Right.
You know, a little interesting story here. I was never a backup. I was never a scout team quarterback my whole life. You know, high school never did it. College, I got hurt the year I would have been a scout team quarterback. So I was injured, came back the next year as a backup. So I was always getting first or second team reps. Was an All-American in college. I was a sixth pick of the draft. Mm-hmm. So as a first-round pick, you don't go in and run the scout team. I was always, even when I wasn't playing, sitting behind Craig Erickson and seeing that aspect of it. Then I was the starter pretty quickly. Well, in 1999, when I broke my shoulder and Sean King came in and my time in Tampa was done, I was too expensive for them at that point. I went to Baltimore, and it was the first time I'm sitting there running scout cards. Mm-hmm. And I'm playing behind Tony Banks, and it was eye-opening. And here's what I learned is that to make a team great, every individual has to embrace their role and treat their role like it's Super Bowl Sunday. They have to take great pride in how they're servicing the greater good, which is the team. Now, you can still be getting better. You can still have goals to be the starter. You can still be competing with another player to try to push him and eventually take that spot. But you better buy into the role that you've been given to help your team. One of the reasons we were so good on defense was because Brandon Stokley and I in training camp gave them a great look. They were mm-hmm. getting a Pro Bowl quarterback against them in training camp on scout team cards. They were getting a future, you know, 100 catch guy in the NFL every single day in the slot. We had other really talented players, Patrick Johnson, who ran 4.3 as an X, giving them scout team looks. So Dwayne Starks and Chris McAllister were getting that beep beep speed on the perimeter every single day. And we took great pride in that. And I really learned what the 53rd guy on the roster has to go through every day, because frankly, I probably was the 53rd guy early on. And it led me to a much less selfish perspective of how teams were built and how teams thrived at a high level. So then when I did become a starter again, I had a better perspective. I was a better teammate. Mm-hmm. When I was hurt again and became a backup again, it became a better, made me a better servant leader. I really had a lot of satisfaction. Don Hasselbeck, Matthew's dad, and I joke about this all the time, that when I think Don and I were more excited when Matthew would throw a touchdown pass than when I threw a touchdown pass. Mm-hmm. Like, we had such joy in seeing his career accelerate and start to grow. And we both of us knew what an influence I had there. Alex Smith, when I got to get to Alex, he had just had a horrific rookie year. So to get him his second year and for Norv Turner to sit me down and say, hey, how you go is how he goes. And I need you to wear a lot of hats. You need to wear the competitive hat where you push him every day. You need to wear the nurturer hat. You need to wear the coach hat mm-hmm. where you're watching film with them. You're going to need to wear the friend hat. Whether he likes you or not, you guys got to be besties because he's going to need you. There's going to be some dark moments. He's going to throw four picks, and you better be on speed dial, or you better hang out with him that night. So I really grew to appreciate that part of it. And so all that carried over to Elite 11, because now to hold a perspective on these four or five-star kids that have everybody pouring perfume on them and trying to give them a different perspective of what their journey may look like. A lot of them have come back to this point and thanked us. And a lot of them now they didn't end up having pro careers, but they're great coaches. They're great mentors. They're using their influence in other areas. And they learned that from being great teammates, not just being great quarterbacks. And now obviously with this job at Lipscomb, teaching a community how to think like that, not just a team, but a community to think like that, has been challenging, but very fruitful.
Yeah, and you know, I think of when you are in that backup position, you kind of have to, like you said, wear a lot of different hats, because you have to kind of be ready to be in that starting role at a moment's notice there. And I think that kind of really came to fruition for you with the Ravens and even with the Seahawks there, kind of coming back in spot starts there. But that idea of preparation, right? That I feel like that's a quality that you can never have too much abundance of. So maybe from a coaching perspective, where we're kind of gearing up for the upcoming season, you know, advice for coaches to prepare during the off season.
Yeah. You know, preparation gets like leadership these days. It gets thrown into this giant bucket of ambiguity. Like, you don't really mm-hmm. know what it means anymore because it has so many different tails to it, has so many different branches to it. Sure. To me, the easiest way I can articulate preparation, the way I do it with our staff and our kids, is the way you do small things is the way you do all things. Mm-hmm. So every little thing matters. You know, for like a coach, scripting your next day of practice is very important, right? Every coach nod their head and be like, yeah, can't function well the next day if you're not scripting well. But how you're evaluating the previous day's film and the notes you're taking and the communication you have with your staff, that leading into scripting the next day, and then taking into account all the little tiny things that go into how many reps has that guy had? Has he run that right? Has he run it left? How many times has he had his hand in the dirt? How many times has he been standing up? Who's been going against in practice? It takes a lot of mental gymnastics to continue to get the details well. Well, excuse me. If you're willing to take every little decision as a big decision, you're naturally going to prepare well. You don't have to tell yourself to work hard. You don't have to tell yourself to prepare hard. It becomes who you are, because you can't sleep at night if you haven't covered every detail, if you haven't prepared for every detail. And it's an accumulation of those little things that allow the big things to naturally take care of themselves. We don't talk a ton. I'll give you an example. And some offensive coaches may freak out when I say this. We talk very little about coverage. I bet you we talk as little as any staff in America about defensive coverages. But we talk a ton about corner technique, corner safety backer triangles, rotations, force players, alley players, you know, how they force, all these different things that basically we're breaking a coverage down to its smallest detail, teaching the details, and then eventually you don't have to talk about the bigger thing. The bigger thing takes care of itself because you've taught all the micro elements of it. So again, that's just one example. I can talk about front seven play very similarly. That, you know, if you're covering every little detail, if you're preparing for every little thing, then a lot of the big things just naturally take care of themselves.
I like that. You know, I like to consider myself a golfer. I'm not a very good one, but the adage that maybe crossover there is aim small, miss small, right? You have a small target there that you're less likely to kind of overshoot things.
So I've learned a ton from golf, by the way. Yeah. I think some of the best influences in my coaching career have been golf instructors. I've worked with a lot of the best ones, from Butch Harmon to you name it. And at one time was a pretty successful golfer and worked very hard on my game. So I learned so much from, you know, a drill that Butch Harmon taught me years ago, where I take the club to the top and I had to start with a wedge, and I take the club to the top and I would have to count to three. And it was amazing just in that three count what my body felt like. It wanted to go, but just letting it breathe and sit up there. And then the point of it is, when I kept the downswing on a full swing, I could now feel every little element of the shaft bend, my grip pressure, the face of the club, where it was at in relation to my body rotation, and hitting literally thousands of wedges from just swinging from the top, taking it back, swinging from the top. How just building it from the micro helped me become a really good wedge player. And it really helped me learn a lot about how the club worked as I swung it. Football is the same way. We had a drill today. We're working a base run scheme, multiple formations, multiple fronts. And I stopped and I said, you know, I haven't done a very good job explaining the why we put this motion on. You know, because kids are going to do what you tell them to do. So we'd add some fancy motion to it for window dressing. And I'm like, wait a second. This is a me issue. This isn't a you issue. Let me explain why we're doing this motion. And the kids had the aha moment, because we took 4 minutes, which in football term, I mean, you can get – 9 plays run in 4 minutes. So we basically sacrificed 9 plays to give them the feel of the club face, right? The understanding where everything's out, why one piece affects the other 10. And you literally had kids look and go, oh, well, that makes way more sense now. And now my job's a lot easier. So I do think there's a lot, and again, this is all under the umbrella of preparation, but you got to be very strategic by how you prepare, making sure you're doing all the little things, and making sure your kids, because they're not naturally going to do the little things, you have to make it a point of emphasis to either do it for them, force them to do the little things,
right,
or explain why the little things are going to add up to the big thing that they really want.
Yeah, and that's great. And I want to be very appreciative of your time here. So I do good. Have another segment that we have here. Oh, fantastic. we have one segment that we like to close out here with before we get to that. But I am, you know, all cards on the table, a huge Patriots fan. Mm-hmm. So I would love, maybe we're about a week away into Patriots training camp opening up. Can you give me a little insight on this Cam Newton, Mac Jones battle here? What do I expect?
Well, I'll give you a little insight. I'll let you guys decide, but I'll give you an insight of one of the realities of what happens in NFL coaching staffs. And then this will lead to your answer. Every staff has what they want to be and what they have to be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Defensively, offensively, special teams. You're talking about the greatest minds in all of football, correct? So they know what they want to be. But the smart ones, Bill Belichick being the smartest of all, go, well, here's what we have to be. And I think that's where the Patriots are right now. They want to be what they were with Tom Brady.
Mm-hmm.
Mac Jones can grow into playing that style of football. Now, I'm not saying he's going to grow into Tom Brady, but I'm saying he can grow into that style of football. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think he can actually add something that Tom was not great at, which is the spit game, which is what he did so much at Alabama, the catch and throw, spit it out to the perimeter, take advantage of, you know, clean looks, right? Tom took him years to be able to get the ball out that type of quick, okay? So I think they can grow into something really special. That's who they want to be. They may not have the ability to be that right now, and it may not be Mac Jones. And everybody thinks it's a Mac Cam thing. Mm-hmm. It might be how they're formatted as a team. You know, and until they can have all their personnel on offense be able to play they want to play, they're going to play the way they have to play. Mm-hmm. And if you saw them last year when they were successful, they played a certain formula. They're going to run the ball between the A gaps. They're going to play action pass. They're very creative. As Josh McDaniels, in my opinion, is one of the most creative coaches in football. He's a way that can find ways, of North Turner used to say it, steal plays. Like, they're going to steal 4 to 6 plays a game somehow. So they may have to play that way. And if they have to play that way, then Cam Newton's going to be the quarterback.
Okay, so I think what to get out of here from all of this is that, if I could steal a headline from you real quick, is that you think Mac Jones is going to be better than Tom Brady? Is that what I'm taking?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is like my ESPN days where I would say something, get hijacked.
Right. No. But I think that's a good point, though, right? Because what I love about Cam Newton is that, you know, he seems like the consummate professional, right? Yep. He seems like the exact teammate that you want. He has the charisma. He has the superstar quality, obviously, that can carry a franchise that you would want out of a, you know, top-tier quarterback. It just feels like, you know, I want the Cam Newton from 2015. You know, it's just the way that he plays, the physicality that he plays, I'm not sure if the Adonis body that he has can hold up to that anymore, which worries me. But I think I love him.
I don't think you're going to see that. I'll throw one at you. I think it's a real possibility. I don't think Bill and Josh are afraid to do this. I'm not a believer in a quarterback platoon system, but I can see how it can work. Like, you can make a real argument for certain teams that it can work. And you could come out, if you're the Patriots this year offensively, and if you've built this thing on special teams and defense, and you're not trying to be, you know, the best offense in the league, you could definitely find a way to make both work. Like, you could play the way you have to play with Cam Newton and try to get the most out of that, and limit his snaps so he can be a little more physical and go back to 2015 Cam, and still pull Mac in there and be more of a, you know, like you were with Tom Brady. I don't want to put a label on it. It's West Coast is what it is, but it's just dressed up different. So you could be kind of a half West Coast team and a half must have to offense, meaning run action, trick plays. There's no reason that couldn't work. I think over time it would probably get exposed a little bit, but that time would also give Mac the opportunity to get on the field and make some big boy decisions and be in some 2-minute situations, some must pass situations, and grow as a player where it doesn't feel like he's holding the weight of the franchise on his shoulders.
Okay. I would like to see Mac Jones get a little bit of reps this year. You know, the national championship game, Alabama, you're very familiar with the Dilfer Dimes there. He can put a drop in a bucket, you know, a couple of times. So I would like to see something like that. But again, you know, it's, I feel like, yeah, as a Patriots fan, you're just kind of in purgatory right now after, Tom Brady leaves. So you're just kind of waiting for the next thing here. But we have our last segment, which I like to do with all of our guests here, which is five questions that have nothing to do with sports, but it's so rare that we get a professional athlete in here. So this is five questions that have nothing to do with offensive players. Okay, so it's kind of a lightning round question here. So you're physically ready? You're mentally prepared?
Physically, I don't know about mentally, but go ahead. Physically, I'm fired up.
All right. Best defensive back you've ever played against?
Deion.
Yeah?
Deion Sanders was amazing. I mean, I'd put Leroy Butler up there. I'd put Rod Woodson up there, who I played against and played with. Mm-hmm. But Deion Sanders just, I mean, he literally, when they say took away half the field, he did.
Now, how about the best sack specialist, to put in quotations there? Maybe the hardest hitter you've ever went up against?
Reggie White's the greatest football player I ever played against. With his 30 plays, he decided to play hard. He was literally unblockable, no matter how many people you put on him. I mean, I played with Ray, so mm-hmm. I didn't really ever play against Ray. I played against Ray late in my career, but when I'd gone to San Francisco. But Reggie White was... I mean, you can't explain. Derek Thomas, you can't explain either. Derek Thomas and Reggie mm-hmm. White, I don't have the vocabulary to explain how awesome they were.
Is it a different feeling when they hit you from behind or something like, you know, do you know that it's a Derek Thomas hit? Do you know that it's a Reggie White hit?
Reggie was such a good man. He would hit you and then in the air turn. So he wouldn't land on you. So Reggie's hits didn't hurt that bad because he was protecting you. Like, he didn't ever want to hurt anybody. Mm-hmm. Derek just ran through you. trying to think who the hardest hitter was.
Reggie White, you know, he's a man with a collar, so that makes sense, right?
Yeah, the hardest hit I ever took was from Johnny Randall. He hit me my second year in the back, and on a blind, it was a legal hit. I was rolling out to my right, it pulled up like a knucklehead, and he got his shoulder pads in the middle of my back, and my helmet hit my heels.
Oh, jeez.
Now think about that.
Yeah. That's pretty flexible. It's pliability. It's what we're talking about.
And I wasn't very flexible. Yeah. That was the impact of the hit.
Yeah, that's impressive there. Maybe this falls in line here. The best trash talker you ever played against or played with?
Johnny Randall. I mean, yeah. I don't think there's a – he's first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth. I mean, he knew everything. He'd study your bio. He would, you know, he'd never shut up. Even in practice, when I played with him in Seattle, it was classic. You know, he knew everything about his teammates, and he would talk to his teammates. I mean, he just had to be talking. 90% of it was harmless and fun. But, you know, to young players like myself, when we played in 94, 95, 96, he definitely occupied a little space in my kitchen.
Yeah, he's got to be a menacing force there. He had all the face paint there.
He was the first guy. Yeah, he was the first guy with all the face paint. Yeah, he's a bad man.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to line up opposite him. That's right. But I'm 170 pounds, so that's that's that. What's the best piece of advice you were ever given on the football field?
You know, probably be me. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a lot of really wise. It's Pro Bowl in '97. I only got to go to – I was only good enough to go to one. Probably didn't deserve to go to that one. But it was interesting. Chris Carter, who's become a lifelong friend, Barry Sanders, Reggie White. Like, there were so many all-time greats, Brett Favre, Steve Young. And I remember playing golf with Steve, who's one of my dear friends to this day. We were playing golf up at the golf course on a after practice one day. And he said, you know, what I see in you, Trent, is that you're not comfortable being you. Like, when you're out here and you're you, you're dynamic, you have a great personality, you're a leader, and then you get in and you try to be something else as a player, and then it gets you in trouble. And, you know, I think as I – the more I was me, just mm-hmm. a better version of me each day, each year, but was comfortable in my own skin, the better player I was. And you see so many young athletes, probably even worse now with social media and with all the inputs that they have, that they're trying to be something they're not. Mm-hmm. Just be yourself. It's the most authentic you is the you that's going to be the best you in a locker room setting. So that's probably some of the best advice I ever got.
Yeah, and I think, you know, particularly from the high school level too. I mean, you don't even necessarily know who you are at that point too. I mean, you're still developing and figuring that out. So to think that you have to have, you know, one lane picked at that point in time, you know, is not necessarily the only way to go about it, right?
Yeah, the false bravado of teenage boys really gets in their way and stops them from being the best versions of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, flip side of this question, best piece of advice you've ever given to a player or peer relating to the football?
Your identity is not what you do, it's who you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I, along with that false bravado, a lot of it's identity crisis. So a lot of what I think one of the reasons we're pretty good at what we do here is we have a coaching staff that really wants to allow the kid to know that he's not the drop ball and he's not the touchdown. He's mm-hmm. not the missed block and he's not the pancake. He's not the tackle. He's not the missed tackle. That's not who he is. It's what he does. And he wants to do it well each time he has a chance to do it. But he's something far bigger than that. He's got a purpose far greater than playing football. When kids tap into their identity, their true identity, and find comfort with that, all of a sudden the things they do become better. But more importantly, they lay their head on the pillow each night and they have peace. Not necessarily happiness all the time, but they have peace with who they are, where they're at in life, what they're doing, what they're here for. You get a tribe of kids believing that, feeling that. You get a bunch of coaches encouraging that, and magic happens.
I love that. Well, you successfully passed five questions that have nothing to do with offensive players. A little change here. I think you were mentally and physically ready for that. So give yourself a little more credit than that. But Trent, I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to speak with us today. Where can the people get in touch with you on social media if you would like them? Not everyone wants that.
Yeah, Dilfer's Dimes is the Twitter handle since my time at ESPN. And Instagram is Trent.Dilfer, I believe. Yeah, Trent.Dilfer. So I'm active. I'm not super active. I do it more for the program. But, yeah, I'm active. And if you want to reach out, disagree, agree, connect, I'm here.
I love it. We'll get fired up for it. And you can, once again, follow our brands on Twitter, @coach_AD, @TrainCondition, @WinningHoops, and then myself, as always, @WesleySykes_. And you want to be following all of those accounts to get a first look at who our next guest will be for our first episode in August. But until then, sports fans, my name is Wesley Sykes, and thank you for listening to another edition of Sideline Sessions. And thank you, Trent.
You got it. Thanks for having me.